This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. Taliban fighters took control of a key district in Afghanistan's northern Kunduz province on Monday and encircled the provincial capital, according to police, as the insurgent group added to its recent battlefield victories while peace talks have stalemated. The Taliban's gains came as the Pentagon reaffirmed the U.S. troop withdrawal was still on pace to conclude by early September. A spokesman said fighting around Imam Asaibi district began late Sunday, and by midday Monday, the Taliban had overrun the district headquarters and were in control of the police headquarters. U.S. Special Representative for North Korea Sung Kim met South Korea's Unification Minister Lee In-young, who handles relations with the North in Seoul, on Tuesday during his first trip since assuming the role last month. Kim said the two countries agreed to pursue complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula through diplomacy as well as dialogue, while Lee said that he looked forward to North Korea coming forward for a dialogue soon. Kim, who arrived in Seoul Saturday for a five-day visit, had back-to-back meetings with South Korea's top nuclear envoy as well as a trilateral session involving his Japanese counterpart. British Royal Navy commanders say the UK's newest aircraft carrier, HMS Queen Elizabeth, is helping to take on the lion's share of operations against the Islamic State group in Iraq. Meanwhile, Russian warplanes are trying to keep tabs on its cutting-edge F-35 jet in a cat-and-mouse game with British and U.S. pilots. Speaking aboard the carrier on its first-ever deployment, the Commodore Steve Morehouse said the U.K. is carrying out most missions to wipe out the remnants of ISIS. This is VOA News. Taiwan criticized Hong Kong Monday in an escalating row over signing a letter supporting China's sovereignty claims over the island, which had prompted Taiwan to pull out officials from its representative office in the Chinese-run city. Taiwanese staff working on the island's representative office in Hong Kong started leaving the financial hub from Sunday after the government there demanded its officials sign a document supporting Beijing's One China claim to Taiwan. Hong Kong has become another source of tension between Taipei and Beijing, especially after Taiwan said a security law imposed on Hong Kong by Beijing and began welcoming Hong Kong people to settle on the democratic island. They said the office in Hong Kong will maintain operations, but Taiwan will take necessary measures if its presence there is further jeopardized. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki outlined actions the United States had taken in conjunction with the EU and Canada to impose sanctions on key members of the regime in Belarus. The sanctions were imposed on several senior officials in Belarus over the forced diversion to Minsk of a passenger plane traveling between two EU countries last month. Asset freezes and travel bans were also imposed on a number of officials linked to the security crackdown that continues to rock the country some 10 months after President Alexander Lukashenko was returned to power and elections branded by the EU and others as fraudulent. Among those targeted by the United States were close Lukashenko associates, those accused of helping to violently suppress peaceful protests since last year, and others alleged to have orchestrated fraud during the elections. Cuba's government announced on Monday that its three-shot Abdallah vaccine has proved to be 92% effective against the coronavirus. It provided no details of the clinical testing, but the Abdallah is one of the vaccines Cuba is testing. It's recently said its Soberana 2 vaccine has shown a 62% efficacy. The announcement came as Cuba faces its worst outbreak since the start of the pandemic, with record new infections. The World Health Organization said on Monday it's setting up a technology transfer hub for producing the mRNA COVID-19 vaccines in South Africa, which could start manufacturing doses in 9 to 12 months. More at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, June 22nd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Polls remain open for hours in Monday's Ethiopia parliamentary election.
After 12 hours of voting, when the polls were supposed to close, election workers said turnout was better than expected and voting had been conducted safely.
Rights groups urged the European Union not to lift sanctions on Burundi. Northeast Nigeria faces acute life-threatening hunger. Uganda's health minister blames the public for rising COVID cases. Zimbabwe sees an alarming rise in urban poverty levels. And ECOWAS notes positive developments in Mali, but maintains the suspension.
The head of state noted the positive development in Mali in terms of the appointment of a civilian as the prime minister and the formation of a new government, but that does not mean they lifted. And if you look at it, they decided to remain seized of the political situation in Mali.
And there are concerns for Senegal's precious mangrove ecosystems. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Polls in Ethiopia remained open for hours after the planned closing time on Monday, with people waiting all day to cast ballots in parliamentary elections. But as viewers Heather Murdoch reports from Addis Ababa, some regions in Ethiopia have delayed their vote or are not participating at all.
After 12 hours of voting, when the polls were supposed to close, election workers said turnout was better than expected and voting had been conducted safely. But with crowds of people still waiting in line, voting was extended for hours. Election organizers said logistical problems like missing poll workers, missing ballots, and bad weather were to blame. Eden Hagos, a 27-year-old receptionist, said she was excited to vote. But after waiting all day, she was not sure she was still interested. But other voters said they would wait as long as it took. Ayalu Gebre Mikhail, a 43-year-old fitness instructor, said this election may end decades of one-party rule as dozens of parties are competing. The ruling Prosperity Party is widely expected to win, giving Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed a popular mandate after 3 years of rule by appointment. Opposition parties are also expected to win some seats in the national and local contests. In the office of the Ethiopian Citizens for Social Justice, the main opposition party, officials said they counted more than 200 election irregularities, ranging from missing ballots to observers being intimidated at the polls. But overall, party chair Yeshewas Asifa said he believes the election could be a historical move towards a more democratic government.
This may be not the last, but very important chance to transform to democracy.
But there will be no voting at all in Ethiopia's northern region of Tigray, which has been at war with the federal government for more than 7 months. Several other areas are postponing their votes until September due to security concerns and, in some cases, missing ballots. Also missing are European Union observers who declined to attend after being denied permits to use their equipment in Ethiopia. Analysts say if this election does, in fact, produce a more politically diverse government, achieving an enduring pluralistic democracy will take time. Lawyer and political analyst Kia Teske.
There are politicians who really believe in the electoral process. There are also politicians who believed they can cling to power through shortcut.
He says despite the canceled and postponed votes, he expects the elected parliament to have a strong majority that is able to form a government. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
Human Rights Watch is calling on the European Union not to lift sanctions on Burundi because that country is yet to improve its human rights record since President Evariste Ndayishimiye came to power a year ago. In a joint letter with other rights groups to the Council of the European Union and its preparatory bodies, Human Rights Watch called on the European body to honor its commitment to human rights in Burundi. This as the EU reviews the human rights situation in Burundi. However, supporters of the Burundian government say the country's human rights record has improved and are urging the European Union to consider lifting sanctions. Louise Marge is the Central Africa Director for Human Rights Watch. He tells viewers Peter Clotty that the EU should not lift sanctions due to ample evidence of ongoing human rights violations in Burundi.
In light of Burundi's failure to respect human rights obligations in early 2016, there was a suspension by the EU of direct financial support to the Burundian government. And now, in this month, the EU is now indicating that it will reverse that decision. Now, the problem for us at Human Rights Watch and for the other signatories of this letter is that there has been a downtick in some of the most egregious types of abuses in Burundi. That is true. There have been some symbolic gestures made by the current president, Evariste Ndayishimiye, with regards to human rights. That is also true. And yet, if the EU continues on this track, it will be not honoring its human rights commitments, because the systems that have been put in place, in particular since 2015, the systematic change that is needed is not actually addressed at all.
Is Human Rights Watch basically saying that some of the gestures made by the newly installed president who came to power about a year ago is just mere superficial and not enough?
Yeah. Some of these steps that have been taken, yes. Are they positive or negative? Sure, they are positive. They are not enough. They are gestures, and they, moreover, they fail, unequivocally fail to address the systems that are in place, the systematic human rights abuses that are occurring in Burundi to this day. And moreover, by treating these gestures, these piecemeal gestures, as real change, and by pulling up this suspension and turning it around, they're basically sending a message to the Burundian government saying, you can get what you want as long as you implement piecemeal and changes that are merely gestures and don't address the actual system that has put those abuses in place.
What specific measures or steps do you think the European Union should watch as benchmarks in order to reverse these sanctions imposed on Burundi?
The benchmarks are absolutely there. There's supposed to be a schedule of commitments taken by the governor of Burundi to address human rights abuses. And these commitments include reining in abusive government members, including members of the Imbonerakure, which is a youth militia tied to the ruling party, the CNDD-FDD, and reduce their involvement in human rights abuses, especially in the provinces. There's supposed to be accountability for the many people who've been killed, especially since 2015. There's supposed to be an opening of the space for media stations and for journalists to do their job. And the fact is that the Burundi that we're in now, there's only a red line. There, journalists know that there's certain issues now that they can't talk about. Letting a few radio stations back on the air, but telling them you can't talk about certain issues is not exactly opening up the space. It actually solidifies how closed the space is.
Louise March is the Central Africa Director for Human Rights Watch. You're speaking with VOA's Peter Clotter. Leaders of the Economic Community of West African States are welcoming what they call positive steps taken thus far by the military-led transitional government in Mali towards returning the country to democratic civilian rule. At their summit held over the weekend in the Ghanaian capital, Accra, the leaders took note of the appointment of a civilian prime minister and the formation of a new government. However, the leaders did not lift the suspension of Mali imposed after the military seized power. ECOWAS Political Affairs Director, Dr. Aderemi Ajebewa, says the leaders decided to remain engaged in the political situation in Mali through its envoy and former Nigerian President Goodluck Ebele Jonathan.
After the last extraordinary summit held in 30th May, the mediator in the person of His Excellency Goodluck Ebele Jonathan, the ECOWAS Special Envoy, was mandated to go immediately to the country to meet with the stakeholders and to reiterate about the transitional program to be strictly adhered to. So the mediator, as well as his team, met with the stakeholders and they took note of the appointment of the civilian prime minister then. Also, the president of the country, Colonel Goita, reaffirmed their commitment that they will respect the electoral timetable, which will include the organization of a credible, fair, transparent election in February 2022. They also inform the mediator and the team that in as much as possible, that they will speed up actions to ensure that it's going to be an inclusive government, given the fact that the Prime Minister himself took us down the memory lane, that he was part of the people who started the struggle in ensuring that various sectors of the country are included.
It seems that the heads of state were pleased with the developments in Mali. Does this mean now that they have lifted the suspension on Mali?
No. The head of state noted the positive development in Mali in terms of the appointment of a civilian as the prime minister and the formation of a new government. And not only that, also the commitment to that roadmap, as well as knowing fully well that none of them will be seen as a candidate in the coming election. But that does not mean they've not lifted. And if you look at it, they decided to remain seized of the political situation in Mali. So it's not been lifted. None of the Malians will be appointed to any of the international positions or invited to the ECOWAS members' meetings.
I'm sure everyone in the region is looking forward to this common currency, which already has its name, the ECO. I think it should have been launched. What was the decision on the common currency?
There's an agreement, you know. There's what we call the convergence principle. The implementation of it has been some of the problem. You know, we are looking to single currency. Initially, it was 2007, but later on 2020. But now, the head of state, given the ministerial committee on the single currency, they came out with what we call a convergence and microeconomic stability pact between the member states. And they look at the convergence phases to cover from 2022 to 2026, so that the stability phase for the ECO to come into effect, we are looking towards the 1st January 2027 now.
Dr. Aderemi Ajibewa is Director of Political Affairs for the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS. He was speaking with us from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, June 22nd. The United Nations is urgently appealing for $250 million to provide life-saving food assistance for millions of people in northeast Nigeria, many of whom risk starving to death. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The UN resident and humanitarian coordinator for Nigeria, Edward Callan, says he has come to Geneva to warn the international community that Nigeria is at a crossroads and in urgent need of humanitarian assistance. He says 4.4 million people in northeast Nigeria's Borno, Adamawa, and Yobe states are facing a looming catastrophic situation of food insecurity that eventually could result in a famine.
Of these 4.4 million people, 775,000 are in critical need of food assistance and risk death and also further dispossession if necessary action is not taken now.
Callan says malnutrition rates are rising in all three states in northeast Nigeria, reaching a particularly dangerous high of 13.6% in Yobe State. The UN Children's Fund reports severe acute malnutrition causes stunting, wasting, physical and mental impairment, and even death. UN Coordinator Callan says these children urgently need special nutritional feeding to save their lives. However, providing aid in this volatile region is dangerous and in some cases impossible.
One, because of the ongoing insecurity, which is resulting in further displacement of people and also compounded by the socioeconomic impact of COVID-19. And closely linked to the issues of insecurity is issues of access in areas that are controlled by the non-state armed groups, where we have well over 800,000 people we cannot reach.
Northeast Nigeria has been in almost constant turmoil since the Boko Haram insurgency began in 2009. And the situation has grown worse in recent months with a wave of mass kidnappings for ransom. The United Nations reports 8.7 million people in northeast Nigeria need humanitarian aid. Earlier this year, the UN appealed for $1 billion to assist 6.4 million of the most vulnerable. To date, only 55% of the required funding has been received. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Uganda's health minister last Thursday blamed the public's failure to take precautions for an increase in coronavirus cases that is stretching the country's hospitals and oxygen supplies. Dr. Jean Ruth Acheng also welcomed France's donation of 170,000 doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine, saying it comes at a crucial time. Halima Athumani reports from Kampala.
France has donated 175,200 doses of the AstraZeneca coronavirus vaccine to Uganda as part of the COVAX facility sharing agreement among countries. As of June 14th, Uganda had vaccinated 806,129 people. Health Minister Jean Ruth Acheng says the delivery of the vaccine is very timely considering Uganda is facing the wrath of the coronavirus. While receiving the vaccine Thursday, Acheng said the situation in which Uganda is in requires all hands to come together and address the pandemic. She, however, puts the blame on Ugandan citizens.
Ugandans, we are not listening when we are saying we have variants in the country. And the variants give you 2 months as it is spreading. Thereafter, the result is what we are seeing. No amount of oxygen, no amount of vaccines, no increasing ICU beds will get us out of this situation.
Uganda is expected to receive another 688,000 doses in August from the COVAX facility. Munir Safdian, the UNICEF country representative, says that even though Uganda expects more vaccines in coming months, Ugandans need to continue protecting themselves by wearing masks, washing hands, and social distancing if they are to survive the coronavirus.
That vaccines are coming in and they will keep coming in. But there is another vaccine that is available in the hands of every citizen already. Follow the standard operational procedure to protect yourself.
On Monday of this week, reports of vaccine theft emerged, with the Uganda police saying they had arrested 10 people in connection with the theft of 600 doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine. In its latest figures, Uganda registered over 1,100 COVID-19 cases, with 950 active cases being treated in health facilities across the country. Uganda has registered 508 deaths, with the highest number of deaths in one day being registered at 49 on Monday of this week. Jules Amand Aniambuso, the French ambassador to Uganda, says France will continue supporting Uganda.
Vaccine should become a global common good. To vaccinate all the world, we should work on it. Then it is the responsibility of the Western developing country to provide the vaccine, to provide oxygen, to provide masks.
Uganda is also facing a medical oxygen supply crisis for its patients in intensive care units, leading to even more deaths. Officials from the Ministry of Health this week revealed that the government had received $7 million from the Global Fund to set up 7 oxygen plants across the country. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala, Uganda.
In a report this month, the World Bank predicts Zimbabwe's economy will grow 3.9% this year, even as the country sees an alarming rise in poverty levels, especially in urban areas. The report says a record 7.9 million Zimbabweans are extremely poor, earning less than $30 a month. As Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare, the government says decent rainfall will help lift the agro-based economy with a bumper harvest.
41-year-old Richard Luzani is one of many unemployed Zimbabweans hoping the economy will recover and that the coronavirus pandemic will end soon. Each day, he pushes a cart full of water buckets while selling the scarce precious liquid in Headcliff, one of the poorest suburbs of Harare. He works with his 58-year-old father, Weluzani. He says, "I wish I could get any formal job. I'm just barely making a living from this hustle of selling water so that my family can survive. But so far, everything is down, he says. He says on a good day, they go home with $5 each, but other days, nothing. That is not the case with the 40-year-old Tafadzwa Gamanya in Goromonzi, a rural area about 50 kilometers east of Harare. A World Bank report says Zimbabweans living in rural areas are doing better than their counterparts in the urban areas thanks to subsistence farming. So is Gamanya. He says, this year is much better for us here. We had good rains. We have enough water to irrigate our crops until the next rain season. I have maize and sweet potatoes. My peas are at flowering stage. I sell my vegetables to get money for sugar, for tea, which we have with sweet potatoes. Our maize is enough for this year. We have nothing to ask or cry for, says Gamanya. Last week, President Emmerson Mnangagwa's government said the number of food insecure Zimbabweans had drastically fallen because of the good rains the country has enjoyed during the 2020-2021 agriculture season. Mukami Kariuki, who heads the World Bank in Zimbabwe, says the economy could recover faster depending on how the pandemic and the regional economy performs.
That Zimbabwe's economy is projected to grow at a faster pace than its neighbors, rising from 3.9% in 2021 to 5.1% in 2022. By comparison, the average growth rate for sub-Saharan Africa in 2021 is 2.8%. So overall, we note that the recovery of the economy is on a positive trend, and if sustained, this momentum will impact positively on the lives and livelihoods of the people of Zimbabwe.
An upward swing would be welcome news for Richard Luzani and millions of Zimbabweans like him. The World Bank reports 49% of the country's population now live in poverty due to both the pandemic and ailing economy. Columbus Mavungam for VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
An oil and gas field is being built offshore near Senegal's Saloum Delta, where precious mangrove ecosystems exist. If it's business as usual, the installation will harm the mangroves, says Papa Mawad Wad, Director of Programs for Wetlands International Africa. He says the economic value of the mangroves, which adds up to 1.5 million euros over the course of 10 years, must be taken into consideration and innovation methods of exploration used to ensure the survival of the mangroves.
When we talk about the economic value of mangrove ecosystem, we talk about the total economic value of these ecosystem services. We can talk about the provisioning services, fish products, mangrove food also. Mangrove also plays regulating, they provide regulating services, for example, protect the coastline against storms, for example, sustaining, also improving the soil. Maybe last but not least, cultural ecosystem services also. As you may know, in Saloum, mangroves are used by local people since many years now for their cultural activities, and many of these mangrove forests are sacred forests. We had started a study 2 years ago. According to this study, this Saloum Delta offer total ecosystem services around 964 billion of CFA between 2019 and 2029. The main objective of this study was to showcase to politicians the real economic value of this mangrove.
Speaking of politicians, what is the Senegalese government strategy currently?
Yes, to maintain these ecosystem services means to restore the degraded mangroves, because only healthy mangrove can provide these services.
That was Papa Mawad Wad, Director of Programs for Wetlands International Africa. You are speaking to Ricky Stryer from Dakar. And that's it for this Tuesday, June 22nd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington saying, have a